the viewpoints and opinions expressed on this broadcast are the viewpoints and opinions of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints and opinions of this show, its host, or the management of this station. You are listening to WGNS.
This is WGNS Action Line. Action Line.
Featuring on the WGNS Action Line.
Featuring.
Coming to you for the 13th year in a row.
The monthly edition of the Rutherford County District Attorney Show.
The monthly District Attorney Show.
Featuring Rutherford County District Attorney General Jennings Jones, along with Assistant DA Trevor Lynch, with host, retired Assistant Rutherford County District Attorney J. Paul Newman.
We welcome everyone to the program. My name is J. Paul Newman. My co-host today, Rutherford County Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. We thank WGNS for providing the airtime. And we also thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We will begin our broadcast after you listen to these important messages.
Local farmers, local meats, vegetables, and other produce at the Winter Spring Rutherford County Farmers Market.
Bundle up and make your way every Friday at Lane Agri Park.
This message brought to you by the Central Tennessee Regional Solid Waste Planning Board. Visit RecycleRightTN.com for tips, ideas, and locations on where to recycle near you. That's RecycleRightTN.com.
Recycle right, it's all on you. Don't be trashy, recycle classy, recycle right, Tennessee.
Go to RecycleRightTN.com.
Recycle right, Tennessee.
On air, online, and on the phone. You can listen to us anywhere. News Radio WGNS is Rutherford County's place to talk.
We welcome you to the 145th edition of the District Attorney Show as part of the Action Line on WGNS. Today, in the Call to Conviction segment, we will profile the case that helped to start the cold case unit of Rutherford County and also was instrumental in establishing this program on WGNS.
The monthly District Attorney Show with host, retired Assistant Rutherford County District Attorney J. Paul Newman.
This is Paul Newman. This broadcast often asks for the community's help in solving cold case homicides. It is my belief that the law enforcement agencies that deserve special recognition for citizen service are those agencies that address the need for cold case homicide investigation units. Our community was blessed to have a community leader who distinguished himself in this area. That leader is former Rutherford County Sheriff Truman Jones. Under Truman Jones's leadership, the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office established the first cold case investigation unit in Rutherford County. It is a unit which had remarkable success and sent a clear message that unsolved murder cases are never closed, for there is no expiration date on a murder case. It also sent the message that a murder victim's family should never feel abandoned, because law enforcement never forgets an unsolved murder or its victim. And the final message is that people who commit murder should always know that law enforcement may be coming at any time to hold them accountable for taking a human life. On this broadcast, we are profiling a true super case. It is the case that led to the creation of Rutherford County's Cold Case Investigative Unit. It is the 1984 murder of Laura Salmon.
Coming to you for the 13th year in a row, the monthly District Attorney Show.
From call to conviction. Time now for a look back at one of the more intriguing and important cases for this community. From the crime, the investigation, to the prosecution.
We had mentioned earlier the Laura Salmon case in which Cal Gilley was convicted, and we have with us one of the detectives that worked that case, Detective Dan Goodwin. Detective Goodwin, can you give us kind of an overview of the early history of the Laura Salmon case?
Laura was an 18-year-old freshman, had just completed her freshman year at MTSU in May of 1984. Was off for the summer and had just begun a job not too long before working at the then new Kroger on what was Tennessee Boulevard. On May 31st, she completed her shift, got off at about 1:05, left the parking lot. She was observed by a coworker and headed towards MTSU. She was planning to apply for readmission. She'd had some rough grades in the spring semester, and she was not seen again until about 5:40 to 6 o'clock that afternoon. Her body was discovered at the end of a farmer's lane out past the stone quarry off Dole Springs Road out there. She was found out in that field. Officers arrived. They cordoned off the area, took a lot of photography. No one knew who she was at the time. She was identified with her senior ring that she was wearing when they got her to the morgue at the county hospital. Autopsy was performed. It was determined she was killed by multiple blows to the head with rocks that were found in that area. There were suspects immediately. Gilley was one of them, and he had an alibi of sorts at the time from a now deceased person, and then some forensic technology at the time, which was nothing compared to what it is now, came out that there was a hair found in the car that was a 1 in 5,000 match for a man whose name came up the following day in Metro on a rape case. And they kind of canceled each other out for a good long time. Gilley had his alibi and it was a 1 in 5,000 match, and that there was no way to put those two folks together, the other suspect as well as Laura. They could not be put together.
Now, once the case became cold, it remained dormant for some period of time. Detective Goodwin, can you tell us about what happened when you became involved in the investigation and what caused you to get involved?
A tip came in from a school resource officer at Oakland High School, David Krim. A teacher at his school had overheard conversation between a boy at the school and a friend of his, and the boy said, "What would you think if you knew that your father had killed a woman and threw in a rock quarry?" So that got us looking into it. It took us about 2 weeks to go down that path, including trying to get a prospective DNA profile on the man who was being spoken of. The father the boy was talking about had actually been dead himself since 1987. He was the victim of a violent death. So we had to get a profile by getting DNA from his family members. Interviewed everybody we could. There was no known nexus between that person and Laura Salmon, but that had gotten the case started again, so we began back on the original file and set out to get other DNA profiles that might go back to the scene. This case, you see, happened a number of years before DNA profiling came into effect, and for whatever reason, none of it had been submitted before or efforts made to go to those different people. So we quickly, especially with the help of Manatee County Sheriff's Office Detective Rick Gerken, we were able to write a search warrant and get Gilley's DNA in April of 2000. And that came back with a hit on him as being at the scene because of evidence there. On the 16th anniversary of her murder, on May 31st of 2000, he was a positive hit.
The physical evidence was examined carefully, and scientific evidence was a big part of this case. But how important was citizen involvement? Was there a large number of people who came forward and gave testimony and evidence concerning the relationship between the defendant and the victim?
We interviewed well over 150 people. Some we generated ourselves, and as word got out, more of them started saying, "Hey, we know something." I believe, as far as our bad acts go, and we found over 20, I believe it's 23, 21 or 23 physical assaults that Gilley had perpetrated on her. Keep in mind, he was a year younger, still a high school guy, and he was beating on her frequently. We were able to finally use 8 of those at trial, and that effect kept going. Every person we talked to, we'd say, "Who else should we talk to?" And they had a list of names. And in the final analysis, what boiled down was originally no one talked to high school friends of Laura. They talked to college friends, but not people that were still in school or had just graduated. They were, by and large, just not spoken to.
And how important is it to make sure that you contact every person and try to establish what was going on in that person's last 48 hours?
Yeah, or as far back as you can go. We pretty much knew what she did that entire week from the Friday before, when both the high schools graduated, Riverdale and Oakland, all the way through to her leaving the parking lot the day she died.
One of the unique things about this case was that Cal Gilley was charged initially as a juvenile.
Yes, sir.
And at the time, how old was he?
He was 17 when the murder occurred. I believe it was 2001 when he was arrested, so he would have been under 40 years old at that point, I believe. But he did have to be charged as a juvenile, and one of the first things we did was go before the juvenile court and have to present evidence in order to get him adjudicated as an adult so he could be tried that way. Okay. He was even housed with juveniles that had been adjudicated at the jail until the point he was.
How many years passed before he actually went to trial?
Bill and I felt like it went to sleep, Bill Sharp, that is. We had a bad axe hearing that went on review and finally made it all the way up to the state appellate court after 5 years. And in 2006, they said, we need to go ahead and bring this to trial now, 5 years after the arrest.
I know that you have not only investigated cold cases, but other cases as well. Tell us, what is the difference, if there is a difference, in cold case investigation as opposed to other criminal investigations?
Well, particularly in homicides, you know, there's a TV show, The First 48 Hours, as you know, as a former homicide investigator yourself, is really the first 72 hours a hot case. You're fighting against time, going as rapidly as you can. A lot of times we have a hot murder, if you will. Folks don't sleep for several days. They're trying to get everything they done that they possibly can. In cold cases, time is on your side. The passage of time up to a certain point helps you because relationships change, as we've found in all the cases we work. We mine now bad relationships to find nuggets of information, and a lot of times those nuggets are admissions to a murder, and we can get into it a little bit later, but those admissions have basically been our stock in trade, finding people that the bad guys have told they did it.
Yes. Can you tell us, why should the community want to become involved in investigation of a homicide?
Basically, it's a civic duty if you have knowledge. And one of the things we run into, General, is that many of the people that we speak to are reticent at first. They think because they've had knowledge and not shared it, not immediately called 911 and told someone that they're in some sort of trouble themselves. That's just not true. By and large, one of the things, especially in the Salmon case, we found is folks hadn't come forward because the police had never gone to talk to them. Fortunately, we found a dear friend of hers early on, and she gave us a number of names, and that launched a whole series of events.
And General Weitzel, can you tell us some of the interesting aspects of the trial itself?
Paul, I think one of the interesting aspects and one of the things that we really didn't concentrate on back in the early and mid-80s was the blood spatter evidence. There was a pair of blue jeans that had Mr. Gilley's DNA on it, and also the blood that was deposited during the beating of Miss Salmon. And we had Jerry Finley from Georgia, a blood spatter expert, review those jeans, and his conclusion was that at the time she was killed, the person that killed her was wearing those blue jeans because of the pattern of blood that was on them, and that was a very important piece of evidence. I do remember this. It was one of the most intense trials that I've ever been involved in, and I'm sure you will agree since you were sitting there next to me.
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month.
General Weitzel, how important is the cooperation of WGNS in cooperating and helping us get this information out concerning cold case investigations?
Well, obviously, public is very important. There are people out there that know about these cases, and there may be somebody that knows some details or some specific fact that might come to light and help us solve these cases. So we feel like this will be a way to communicate with the public and hopefully encourage the public to communicate with us or with law enforcement.
Tell the listeners, why is it important to have a cold case unit?
It's important because when we talk about the public at large doesn't have jurisdictional lines. So it's important that all of the agencies involved work as a team. They're kept abreast of what the other agency may be doing. They share information that they have or information that may come to light. And it gives us an ability to use a team approach to trying to solve these cases. It also gives us the ability to have a fresh set of eyes and ears to look at these cases and maybe see something or recognize something that we've missed in the past.
How important is the cooperation of the community in helping us solve these crimes?
It's absolutely imperative that we have the community support. After all, as I said, there are people out there that know about these crimes. They may have seen something. They may have heard something that would be very important or instrumental in solving these unsolved cases. Today's modern jury in the society, the technological society we live in, they expect physical evidence. They expect DNA or fingerprints. And that comes from watching television shows where the latest technology is used to often solve cases. But in my experience, and in particular with cold cases, although technology may help us, it comes down to just good old investigative techniques, talking to people, finding other people, working those cases, and going out and being an investigator.
This is the timeline regarding the murder of Laura Salmon. The defendant was David Cal Gilley, who was 17 years old at the time of the offense. His trial occurred 22 years later when he was 42 years old. Here is a closer look. The offense occurred on May the 31st, 1984, when 17-year-old Laura Salmon was brutally murdered. 17 years later, on November the 15th, 2001, Cal Gilley was arrested. The trial of Cal Gilley began on July the 26th, 2006, and ended on August the 4th, 2006, over 22 years after the murder occurred. Cal Gilley was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. This is J. Paul Newman.
This is Inside the Courts, a look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
Good morning, everyone. This is Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch, and today I will be your tour guide through this episode of Inside the Courts. We begin this segment by stating that none of the defendants named in any upcoming trials have been convicted, and they are presumed by our law to be innocent. With that as a prelude, we will now go inside the courts. Currently pending in our General Sessions Court is State v. Shakira Brown. On October 31st of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call for shots fired at a residence on Las Casas Pike in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Upon arrival, officers discovered Mr. Jaleel Turner lying unresponsive on the floor of his apartment, suffering from a gunshot wound to the abdomen. Mr. Turner later died from his injuries. Detective William Pulleas was assigned as lead investigator. Ms. Shakira Brown has been charged with the second-degree murder of Mr. Jaleel Turner. Ms. Brown is represented by counsel, Mr. Brent Horst, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. This matter is next scheduled for appearance in the General Sessions Court on December 2nd of this year. Pending in our circuit courts, State v. Clinton Johnson. On October 27th of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to an emergency assist where a man identified as Harold Cruz had sustained injuries to the head. At the conclusion of the investigation, Mr. Clinton Johnson was charged with first-degree murder. On January 24th of this year, Mr. Johnson appeared before the General Sessions Court of Rutherford County and bound his case over for presentment to a grand jury. In August of this year, the grand jury indicted Mr. Johnson for first-degree murder and aggravated robbery. His next appearance is scheduled for November 13th of this year. Mr. Johnson is represented by counsel, Mr. Drew Perkins, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. Cases that have resolved over the last year. State v. DeMarcus McClinton. On February 18th of 2024, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call regarding DeMarcus McClinton breaking into the residence of his ex-girlfriend, Tasha Edwards, and her infant child. Mr. McClinton kicked in the door of the apartment and physically assaulted Ms. Edwards and her child. 911 was called immediately by others, and officers responded quickly. Officer Mary Hussles charged Mr. McClinton with aggravated burglary, aggravated assault, domestic assault, and simple assault, and child abuse. A preliminary hearing was held on March 19, 2024, and the matter was bound over to the grand jury. On May 22nd of this year, a jury trial began, and on May 23rd, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. McClinton of all charges. A sentencing hearing was held on August 19th of this year, and Judge Jimmy Turner sentenced the defendant to a total effective sentence of 26 years, 11 months, and 29 days to be served in the custody of the Tennessee Department of Corrections. The defendant was represented by counsel Mr. Ben Wetzel, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Dana Miner. State v. Adarius Robertson. On January 15th of 2023, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to an apartment on Cobalt Roll regarding a shooting that occurred during the early morning hours. It was reported that two victims had been at the apartment, and when they left, they were followed by the defendant, who drove alongside and then behind them. This was around the intersection of South Rutherford Boulevard and MLK Jr. Boulevard. The defendant began to fire into the car at the victims. Bullets struck the rear passenger door, the headrest of the front passenger seat, the front windshield, and the driver's window. The shooting was witnessed by a Rutherford County Sheriff's deputy who was coincidentally stopped at the intersection. The deputy pursued the defendant into the county and back into Murfreesboro, where the deputy was required to terminate pursuit for safety reasons. Shortly thereafter, however, the defendant wrecked his vehicle and was arrested by the Murfreesboro Police Department. A preliminary hearing was held on April 23rd of 2024, and the court bound the matter over to the grand jury. On July 14th of this year, a jury trial was held, and on July 17th, a jury of his peers found Mr. Robertson guilty of two counts of attempted second-degree murder and one count of aggravated assault. A sentencing hearing was held on September 24th of this year, and the defendant received a total sentence of 18 years to serve in the custody of the Tennessee Department of Corrections. The defendant was represented by counsel, Ms. Amanda Gentry, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorneys Tammy Reddick and Sarah Davis. State v. Carmen De La Cruz. On August 17th of 2020, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a residence on Fowler Street in reference to a stabbing. Officers located the body of Mr. Giorgio Zatino. Mr. Zatino had been stabbed 3 to 4 times, including once in the neck, which ultimately caused his death. Mr. Zatino was outside when the attack occurred, but was able to stumble inside and make contact with one of his roommates. Mr. Zatino told his roommate that Carmen De La Cruz stabbed him. Mr. Zatino's blood alcohol content was a .223. And other roommates had advised that there had been a verbal argument between Mr. Zatino and Mr. De La Cruz earlier in the evening. There were no witnesses to the attack. However, officers located three knives in the outside area where the assault took place. Mr. De La Cruz was located, and a search of his car revealed a kitchen knife with Mr. Zatino's blood on it. Mr. De La Cruz told officers that he and Mr. Zatino had gotten into a fight and that Mr. Zatino pulled a knife on him. He was able to take the knife away from Mr. Zatino and he stabbed him with it. Mr. De La Cruz claimed he did not know how many times he stabbed Mr. Zatino. Inconsistencies in Mr. De La Cruz's account led officers to charge him with second-degree murder and aggravated assault resulting in death. A preliminary hearing was held on September 24th of 2020, and the case was bound over to the Rutherford County Grand Jury. On July 31st of this year, Mr. De La Cruz pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter and received a 7-year sentence to serve in Department of Corrections custody. The defendant was represented by counsel Mr. Chris Fisher, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. State v. Brandon Hayden. On May 1st of 2023, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a call about a child rape. Detective Emily Speed was assigned as lead investigator. Detective Speed interviewed the mother of a 3-year-old child that told her mother that her private parts hurt. She then told her mother that put his finger inside her. 17-year-old Brendan Hayden. Mr. Hayden was interviewed and admitted that he had put his finger inside because he was curious and had heard another student fingering someone. A juvenile petition was issued against Mr. Hayden for a rape of a child. A juvenile transfer hearing was later held that year, and the juvenile court ordered the transfer of Mr. Hayden to adult court. In March of 2024, a Rutherford County grand jury indicted Mr. Hayden for one count of aggravated rape of a child. On July 31st of this year, Mr. Hayden pled guilty to attempted aggravated rape of a child and received a 10-year sentence to serve in the custody of Tennessee Department of Corrections. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. Brennan Foy, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Hugh Ammerman. State v. Anthony Caldwell. In December of 2022, Detective Segura with the Murfreesboro Police Department opened an investigation on Mr. Anthony Caldwell regarding allegations of sexual abuse of a minor. The investigation revealed that between February of 2021 and December of 2022, a 12-year-old victim and her 11-year-old sibling were living with their maternal aunt and her husband, Anthony Drew Caldwell. Initially, they lived in Smithville, Tennessee, where the abuse started. However, soon they moved to Murfreesboro, where the abuse continued and progressed. There were thousands of text messages recovered from the victim's phone between her and the defendant. The maternal grandmother became suspicious of grooming behavior and filed a court order to get visitation with the victim and her sister. During the second visit to the grandmother's house, she devised a plan to look at the victim's phone. She watched the victim put in her passcode and remembered it. Then she had her husband take the girls out on the boat for the day and had the victim leave the phone at the house so it wouldn't get wet. During that time, the grandmother was able to open the phone and look at the text messages between the defendant and her granddaughter. She took pictures of the text messages and called the Murfreesboro Police Department to report it. She then drove the girls directly to the police department and turned over the phone. The defendant was interviewed and denied anything sexual and stated he was only joking with his niece, who he viewed as a best friend. The messages and facts from a forensic interview of the victim were presented to a Rutherford County grand jury. In March of 2023, the grand jury indicted Mr. Caldwell for 3 counts of rape of a child, 2 counts of aggravated sexual battery, 2 counts of especially aggravated sexual exploitation of a minor, 1 count of soliciting the sexual exploitation of a minor under 13, and 1 count of continuous sexual abuse of a child. In October of this year, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. Caldwell as charged on all counts of the indictment. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for January 22nd of next year. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. David Clark, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Hugh Ammerman. State versus Travosa Miller. On January 9th of 2023, Detective James Wilkinson with the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned to investigate allegations of child abuse by Travosa Miller. Mr. Miller struck his minor child on the legs approximately 15 times with a belt because the 5-year-old child defecated on the floor. This act left severe whelps and bruising on the child. In March of 2023, a Rutherford County grand jury indicted Mr. Miller for aggravated child abuse of a child under 8 years of age. On October 31st of this year, Travosa Miller pled guilty to the attempted aggravated child abuse of a child under 8. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for February 6th of next year. The defendant was represented by Mr. Daniel Murphy, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Hugh Ammerman. State versus Cheryl Bodily. In March of 2023, Detective Jesse Gamble with the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office was assigned to investigate allegations of child abuse resulting in death. On March 8th of 2023, a 3-month-old child was transported to the hospital. Emergency personnel were unable to resuscitate the child. The child was pronounced deceased at the hospital. An interview of the child's grandmother, Cheryl Bodily, resulted in several conflicting stories being provided by the grandmother, ranging from the child choked while she was bottle feeding it to the child was asleep in the bed next to her while she played on her phone and then fell asleep herself, with Miss Bodily waking up to the child not breathing and being cold to the touch. The bed Miss Bodily was referring to was cluttered with blankets and pillows. A pacifier was found under the blankets. A drug screen of Miss Bodily was positive for Suboxone. An autopsy of the infant revealed that the baby died from acute methamphetamine intoxication. A search warrant was executed on Miss Bodily's phone that showed Miss Bodily was actively involved in drug transactions, including the sale of methamphetamine. In August of 2023, Miss Bodily was indicted for first-degree murder and aggravated child abuse of a child under 8. On October 3rd of this year, Miss Bodily pled guilty to reckless homicide and aggravated child abuse of a child under 8. She received a 12-year sentence to serve in Tennessee Department of Corrections custody. The defendant was represented by counsel Mr. Darren Drake, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Sharon Reddick. State versus Trevor Anderson. On December 20th of 2021, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a domestic disturbance call in a parking lot. Officers made contact with the complainant and a witness that stated Mr. Anderson confronted and threatened the complainant with a firearm. Officers were in the area and responded quickly when a 911 call was made. Officers observed Mr. Anderson at the vehicle and then watched him quickly walk away as they approached. Officers were able to locate Mr. Anderson, and they also recovered a firearm from the vehicle. Mr. Anderson dropped the firearm in the vehicle when he saw officers approaching. In July of 2022, a Rutherford County grand jury indicted Mr. Anderson for possession of a handgun by a convicted felon. On April 14th of 2025, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. Anderson as charged. Mr. Anderson is scheduled to be sentenced later today and faces a range of punishment between 12 and 20 years to be served in Tennessee Department of Corrections custody. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. Darren Drake, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Allison Abbott. Currently set for trial next year, State v. Candace Davis. Trial is scheduled to begin February 2, 2026 on Candace Davis for allegations of second-degree murder, employing a weapon during an offense, and employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel Mr. Will Fraley, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. A trial is scheduled to begin February 9th of 2026 on Corey Lillard Sr. for allegations of first-degree murder, possession of a Schedule II drug with the intent to sell, possession of a weapon by a convicted felon, employing a firearm during a dangerous felony, and possession of drug paraphernalia. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. Will Fraley, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Trevor Lynch. The trial is scheduled to begin on March 2nd of next year on Cameron Jordan for allegations of second-degree murder, reckless endangerment, tampering with evidence, employing a firearm during a dangerous felony, and unlawful possession of a weapon. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. Derek Howard, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. A trial is scheduled to begin May 4th of 2026 on Joseph Gann for allegations of second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, aggravated assault, reckless endangerment with a firearm, tampering with evidence, employing a weapon during an offense, and employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. Josh Crane, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. The trial is scheduled to begin August 3rd of next year on Juan Charco for allegations of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, aggravated assault, tampering with evidence, reckless endangerment with a firearm, employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. Jeff Cherry, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Trevor Lynch. A trial is scheduled to begin August 24th of next year on Salim Hamilton for allegations of first-degree murder, tampering with evidence, possession of a handgun by a convicted felon, employing a firearm during an offense, and employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel, Ms. Heather Parker, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Trevor Lynch. Ahmad Ali and Kenyon Crawford. A trial is scheduled to begin September 14th of next year on Ahmad Ali and Kenyon Crawford for allegations of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, attempted especially aggravated robbery, tampering with evidence, and employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendants are represented by counsels Mr. Brian Lewis and Mr. Luke Willoughby. The state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. And that concludes this episode of Our Look Inside the Courts.
Welcome to the Recycled Minute, brought to you by RecycleRightTN.com.
Here's another recycling or reuse idea for you.
Rocky the Raccoon's got another clever way to make recycling fun for everyone.
Did you know you can turn old plastic bottles into hanging light shades? You'll just cut them into shape, paint them real nice, and then hang them over outdoor LED light bulbs for colorful recycled decor. You'll brighten your space up and prove that every bottle deserves a second chance. I'm Rocky the Raccoon, inviting you to visit my website, RecycleRightTN.com.
And that's today's Recycled Minute with Rocky the Raccoon. Find the closest place to recycle near you by going to RecycleRightTN.com.
We're keeping Tennessee tall.
What's the law? Time now for an examination of the laws of Tennessee. This is not intended to be legal advice and is being presented solely for the informational benefit of our listening audience. You should always consult with an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this episode of What's the Law. Today, I will be very briefly discussing Tennessee Rules of Criminal Procedure Rule 33, a new trial. Rule 33 outlines the procedures for a defendant to obtain a new trial after a jury has heard the proof and delivered a verdict of guilty. The rule has five basic parts. Part A is the motion for a new trial. On its own initiative or a motion from a defendant, the court may grant a new trial as required by law. If the trial was a bench trial, meaning without a jury, the court on motion of the defendant for a new trial may vacate or overturn the judgment, then take additional testimony if it desires, and then enter a new judgment of either guilty or not guilty. Part B, the timing for the motion or amendments. A motion for a new trial shall be in writing, or if made orally in open court, be reduced to writing within 30 days of the date of the order of sentence is entered. The court shall liberally grant motions to amend the motion for new trial up until the day of the hearing on the motion for new trial. The procedures for taking evidence. The court can take testimony in open court on issues raised in the motion. The court can allow affidavits. That may be affidavits in support of the motion filed by the defendant. The state is allowed to file opposing affidavits, and then the defense is allowed to reply or use reply affidavits to respond. Findings and conclusions. In ruling on the motion for new trial, the court on motion by either party shall take and state on the record findings of fact and conclusions of law to explain its ruling on any issue not determined by the jury. Part D, a new trial where a verdict is against the weight of the evidence. A trial court may grant a new trial following a verdict of guilty if the trial court disagrees with the jury about the weight of the evidence. This does not bar a new trial. Upon request of either party, the new trial shall be conducted by a different judge. Motion and arrest of judgment not waived. Even if a new trial is requested, that is not a waiver of the defendant's right to make a motion for the court to dismiss the case. And that concludes this episode of What's the Law?
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month.
If you missed any part of this program, it will be available shortly as a podcast on the WGNS website. As we end our program today, we thank WGNS for providing the airtime. And we thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We leave now by saying, a safe community is the responsibility of each and every one of us. For my two co-hosts, Rutherford County District Attorney General Jennings Jones and Rutherford County Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch, this is J. Paul Newman, bidding all of you a safe and blessed day.
The District Attorney's Office thanks you for listening to today's program. If you have any information regarding criminal activity in our community, please contact one of our law enforcement agencies. The information presented on today's show is solely for informational benefit and not intended to be legal advice. You should always consult an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice. Rutherford County's most trusted name in news. Talk Radio WGNS, Murfreesboro.
Come tour Adams Place and discover living a dream in your senior years.
You don't have to go out and mow the yard. You don't have to rake the leaves. You don't have to wash the car. You don't have to do anything you don't want to.
You do not have the responsibility of your house, worrying about getting shrubbery trimmed, getting a new roof, paying your taxes. All of that is behind you.
This is Terry Deal. Come tour Adams Place and discover living a dream in your senior years on Memorial across from Walmart.